I'll talk a little bit about black holes, but then I'll quickly move on to other things. So, so thanks for the invitation to come and share my work with you all. I'm around for the rest of the day if you have questions, but you can also email me or tweet at me if you are so inclined. Okay, so just to quickly recap, we've been observing gravitational waves for 7 years now. So what have we learned so far? Well, the first most basic thing that we've learned is that compact object binaries that merge within a Hubble time exist in the universe. This is something we didn't know before the first direct detection of gravitational waves, GW150914, that you can see up here. And we also learned about a new class of binary where a neutron star merges with a black hole recently. We didn't know these types of sources existed before, and you can see here the mass distributions inferred for three of these potential NSBH candidates. Can you see my, we've also learned something about the masses of these compact objects. So we now know that neutron stars and black holes and binaries have masses spanning the range between 1 and about 100 solar masses. So here you can see the inferred primary mass distribution using the last two gravitational wave transient catalogs, starting with for binary black holes at around 5 solar masses and going all the way up to around 100, and then zooming in on the low mass end, including the binary neutron stars. We heard yesterday in great detail about their spins or angular momenta, and we think that these values are small. So here you can see a plot that was also shown yesterday, the spin distribution of binary black holes inferred with the last two catalogs, and most of the support lies at low values, clustered around zero. And here's an analogous plot for the neutron star black hole merger candidates in a work that I won't talk about today, but you can see that there might actually even be more support in the NSBH population for low spins compared to the binary black hole population. We've also observed binary neutron star mergers. And the observation of GW170817 taught us that these sorts of sources are the progenitors of some short gamma ray bursts and that they're also the astrophysical sites of heavy element nucleosynthesis. So here you can see the time frequency map of the gravitational wave signal from the binary neutron star merger, and then the photon count rate in the gamma rays. And about 2 seconds after the merger, there was this short gamma ray burst. And then here are the multi-wavelength observations of the kilonova signal from the ultraviolet to the infrared, showing the radioactive decay of these heavy elements that were synthesized in the neutron-rich ejecta produced by the merger. We've also been able to place upper limits on the total energy density of the universe contained in gravitational waves. So that's omega GW, just like we have omega matter or omega baryons. And we've measured this to be less than 5.8 times 10 to the minus 9. And you can see here what this constraint on omega GW looks like as a function of frequency. So the dark black curve is the best measurement from the last observing run. And you can see how it will improve in the future. And then for comparison, you can see what this signal should look like for the binary neutron stars and binary black holes that we've observed so far. Okay, so why should we care about all these things that we've learned? Well, hopefully we want to use these gravitational wave observations to learn about binary black hole formation channels. And to this end, I'm going to tell you about a correlation that we found between the redshift and the effective spin for the binary black hole sources that we've observed in LIGO and Virgo so far. We can also learn about the central engine powering short gamma ray burst jets. So I'll tell you about a multi-messenger method that we developed to constrain the jet geometry using a population of coincident short gamma ray bursts and gravitational wave observations. And then we can also learn about early universe processes like preheating and phase transitions. And to demonstrate this, I'll tell you about the statistically optimal method that we developed for the simultaneous detection of a stochastic gravitational wave background of primordial origin and a foreground of compact object mergers. Okay, so We heard a little bit about binary black hole formation channels yesterday, but just to sort of quickly recap, we think that gravitational wave observations of these sources can tell us how they form and evolve. So there are two main formation channels that we consider. The first is isolated binary evolution in the field. And this is a rough schematic of how that works. So you have two stars. They start off together in a binary on the main sequence. The more massive star begins to evolve, and it overfills its Roche lobe, initiating mass transfer onto the less massive companion. This leaves some sort of stripped evolved star that eventually goes supernova and collapses to a black hole. And then you might have a phase of that where the system is observable as a high-mass X-ray binary. So the first-form black hole is accreting from its stellar companion and emitting X-rays. And then as the second one begins to evolve off the main sequence, it can expand, and the system might undergo a common envelope event where the outer layers of the secondary engulf both the core and the first-form compact object. This brings the system closer together and leaves another one of these evolved stars that eventually goes supernova and collapses to a black hole, and then they're close enough that they can merge. So there are some observational signatures that are predicted by this method. The first is that the spins are going to be preferentially aligned to the orbital length and momentum, and this is because the stars are born together in a binary, and they evolve their whole lives in the binary, and so effects like tides will work to keep the spins aligned. There's also a prediction that the first-form black hole should have a low spin magnitude, and this is because we think that there is efficient angular momentum transport in these stars. So basically, all the angular momentum is stored in the outer layers, and those get blown away, leaving a slowly spinning core. But the second-born black hole might be able to be spun up. So during this phase, when the second star is still on the main sequence, but a compact object has formed, tidal forces can work to spin up the progenitor of this second-formed black hole, leading to a black hole with large spin. And then there's also the prediction of what are called the upper and lower mass gaps in the mass distribution. So the upper mass gap refers to the dearth of black holes that we expect between about 40 and 100 solar masses, and this is caused by a particular type of supernova called a parent stability supernova. And then the lower mass gap is the difference between the most massive neutron star and the least massive black hole, and this also depends on the supernova prescription that leads to the formation of the compact object. And then there's also going to be a preference for equal mass ratios because of the mass transfer physics and because of the initial pairing function of the binary. On the other hand, we have dynamical formation, where you have sort of dynamical assembly where lots of stars and compact objects pair up in a dense environment like a globular cluster or a nuclear star cluster. And so the observational signatures that we can look for in this situation are an isotropic spin tilt distribution, because we expect them to be paired up randomly. We would expect low spin magnitudes, except for in the case of hierarchical mergers. So as a reminder, this is when the merger remnant from a previous binary goes on to merge again. And then in this case, because of the conservation of orbital angular momentum, that black hole will have a spin of about 0.7. And so these sorts of hierarchical mergers can also populate the mass gaps because you can end up with a remnant black hole that has a mass in the gap. And you might have a subpopulation with unequal mass ratios due to the pairing of a second generation black hole with a first generation black hole, for example. Okay, and just to quickly review, since we saw this yesterday as well, but what we actually want to measure when we detect a binary black hole system are the 15 parameters that characterize the system. So there are 8 intrinsic parameters, the 2 masses, and the 2 three-dimensional spin vectors. We typically call the more massive one the primary and index it with 1. And then we also have the extrinsic parameters, like the distance or the redshift to the source, the inclination, which you can see here is the angle between the total angular momentum and the line of sight, and then the sky position. And in addition to the component spins, we often talk about these effective spins. And these are, in the case of this chi effective, it's actually the best measured parameter for spin with gravitational waves. And this is because it enters the waveform at a higher order. And so this is the mass-weighted spin aligned with the orbital angular momentum. And you can see kind of schematically what this looks like. Okay, and as we heard yesterday, instead of just looking at the properties of one specific source, we want to see if we can measure the distribution from which these properties are drawn across the whole population. And so to do this, we look at all the binary black holes that were detected during and including up to LIGO and Virgo's last third observing run with a false alarm rate of 1 per year. So we choose some purity threshold, and this leaves us with 69 binary black hole events. We also account for detector selection effects so that we report the true astrophysical distributions rather than the observed distributions. And in this case, we're going to use one of these parametric or phenomenological models where we're going to say that the distribution of chi effective should follow a Gaussian on the population level, and we want to measure the mean and the width of this Gaussian. And you can see what that inferred distribution looks like here for the last two gravitational wave transient catalogs. So there are a few interesting features. One is that it doesn't peak at zero. It peaks at something like 0.06, which tells us that there are more binaries with positive values of chi effective in the population than with negative values. And so a positive value of chi effective means that the spin tilt is greater than or equal to 90 degrees. So this might be an indication that there is some contribution from the isolated binary evolution channel that will preferentially produce systems that have these small spin tilt angles. However, there is also this non-negligible contribution of sources that have negative chi effective, so spins that are extremely misaligned with tilts greater than 90 degrees, and this would be an indication of dynamical formation because we think it's very hard to make systems that have such highly misaligned tilts in the isolated case. Okay, so usually what we've done is when we try to fit these population level distributions, we assume that the mass, the spin, and the redshift are all independent. But we think that in reality, the formation scenarios are going to imprint correlations between these parameters. So previous work led by Tom Callister found an anti-correlation between the mean of the chi effective distribution and the mass ratio, so that more unequal mass ratios have larger chi effective. And what we wanted to do is to extend this model to look for correlations between spin and primary mass, or spin and redshift, or both. And so you can see here what our phenomenological model looks like. Again, we're fitting the chi effective population level distribution with a Gaussian with some unknown means and widths. And instead of just assuming that these are some constant fixed value, we allow them to vary linearly with the redshift and the primary mass. And for the width, we use the log width to make sure that this parameter is always positive. Okay, and you can see here what our inferred evolution of the mean and the width of chi effective as a function of redshift look like. So for the mean, you can see that it's consistent with a flat, so consistent with no evolution in the mean with redshift. But for the width, and this is on the log scale, on the y-axis, there's a preference for a positive correlation. So this would indicate that the chi effective distribution broadens with redshift. And we find this at a 98.6% credibility in the model when we allow only for correlations between chi effective and redshift. Now, another way to visualize this is to look at slices of the chi effective distribution at different redshifts. So you can see that here, the darkest color is for the smallest redshift of 0.001, and the lightest color, it might be a bit hard to see, but that's for the largest redshift of 1.8. And so you can see in general this trend that as you go to lighter colors, the distribution broadens. We also tried to see if there was a correlation between chi effective and primary mass instead of chi effective and redshift. And you can see the results here. Again, there's the same sort of general trend where the distribution broadens as you go up to higher and higher primary masses. So we find this broadening with primary mass at 93.5% credibility. And then we wanted to see if we could pinpoint which one of these two parameters was driving the correlation. And so we allow for correlations with both redshift and primary mass simultaneously. And when we do this, we find that no correlation with either of these parameters is disfavored at 96.2% credibility, but there's degeneracy and it's hard to tell exactly which one is driving the correlation.
Here you're saying you also want to plot the width as a function of primary mass, and you also find this width increase is primary mass.
Yeah, so the right panel here shows the increase in the width of the distribution with primary mass, but it's a lower significance correlation.
Is it because the primary mass also increases the redshift?
We don't think that's the case. So on the next slide, I'll try to convince you why we think this is real. So exactly, we wanted to see if there were these sorts of like spurious correlations that could be introduced. One possible way that you might get a correlation like this is you could argue that the systems that are observed at larger redshifts are usually weaker, and so we have larger statistical uncertainty in our recovery of chi-factor for those systems. So maybe that could spuriously introduce this sort of correlation. And so to check this, we do some simulations. So first we simulate a population that has no correlations at all, and we try to recover some sort of correlation using the same models. And this simulated population is similar to the GWTC3 population. And you can see here the evolution in the chi-factor distributions with redshift and primary mass for this uncorrelated population. And so these distributions look different from what we saw in the real data. It starts off broad, then gets narrow, and then gets broad again, and there's a lot more uncertainty relative to the distributions that we inferred with the real data, and that's sort of the case for both of these methods. So we find that if you have truly no correlations in your population, you won't get evidence for a correlation. And then we wanted to see if you had a true correlation with primary mass, could that be confused for a correlation with redshift and vice versa? So to do this, we simulate two more populations. One in the dark purple has a correlation between chi-effective and redshift, and in the light purple, the other one has a correlation between chi-effective and primary mass. And in this case, we recover the correlations in the model that allows for correlations with both parameters at the same time. And so here you can see the posteriors on the two correlation coefficients for redshift and primary mass. And so we find that a mass spin correlation is easier to unambiguously distinguish based on these simulations. So you can see that the light purple posteriors are much more narrowly peaked, and they have more support around the true value of there being a correlation with mass, but not with redshift. While in the case of redshift, the posterior is broader, and there's just a less clear signature that this parameter is driving the correlation. So it seems to be the case that our real data has a correlation that's more similar to this simulated population with a redshift correlation.
So here you're showing correlation as far as Z and M.
Which one? The one on the right or on the left? Yeah, so here we have two simulated populations. One has a correlation with redshift in the dark purple, so we simulate 69. Yeah, yeah. And then in the light purple, there's a correlation between chi-effective and M1 in the population of 69 simulated events. And then here we recover the correlation with the model that allows for both parameters to be correlated with chi-effective at the same time. And these are the correlation coefficients that we infer. And so in the case of the mass correlation, you can see that it strongly prefers the correlation to be with mass rather than redshift. This correlation coefficient peaks at zero, while this one peaks around the true value. While in the case of redshift, there's a lot more ambiguity. So this posterior is broader, and there's less clear evidence that it's really the redshift that's driving the correlation. Yeah.
So, but in the other case,
in the left, you know, in that. Yeah, so in these plots, I'm just showing the case where we fit one at a time. We did also fit both at the same time, but there's no correlation, so we expect both to indicate that they're uncorrelated. The punchline is that mass spin correlations are easier to unambiguously distinguish. So if the correlation we had in the real data was really between mass and chi-effective, then it would look more similar to what we see in the light purple here. And we'd be very clearly able to tell that it's mass that's driving the correlation. But in reality, what we see in the real data is more similar to this dark purple, where there's more of this ambiguity between which of the two parameters. So we think that what we see in the real data looks more similar to the simulation where there's a correlation between redshift and chi-effective.
So in your contour plots, are those contours like 1, 2, 3 sigma?
Yeah.
And so the points that you've shown there with the vertical, so that was the fiducial input.
Yeah, that was the true value that we used to simulate our population.
And so therefore, your recovery of the input is just like 2 sigma recovery.
Yeah.
Are you worried then, that you didn't recover the actual input value better than 1 sigma?
No, I think it's okay given that we have 70-ish events. I think recovery at this level is sort of expected with Gaussian noise fluctuations.
So if you do more realizations, you're saying that
you'll average
recover what you put in?
Yeah, and we did test that actually. We simulated an entirely different population with a different random seed, and it shifted around the posterior. So
okay.
Yeah.
Can I also ask about prior on this space? So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they're uniform in these correlation coefficients.
And if you change the assumed prior, does that change anything about what you infer?
It would change the posterior.
It's not driven mostly by the likelihood is, since that's sort of also somewhat driven by your prior assumption.
I mean, so this, because it uses a uniform prior, this is what the likelihood looks like. If for some astrophysical reason you would very strongly expect that there would be a correlation between mass and chi-effective, but not redshift, then you could build that into your prior and that would change the result. But we wanted to sort of be agnostic about what we think actually happens in these astrophysical processes and just present the sort of most uninformative priors. Okay, and so I'll just briefly mention what we think some of the astrophysical implications of this correlation might be. So there are basically two ways where you might get a correlation like this. The first is that you have two different formation channels and the mixing fraction between them changes as a function of redshift. But we think that this would more easily explain a correlation between the mean of the chi-effective distribution and redshift rather than the width. And so as an example, you could imagine that if you had a lot more binaries that formed via isolated evolution at earlier redshifts, this would change your distribution. But this would cause the whole distribution to shift towards positive values, including the mean, rather than just causing a broadening. So we think that it's more likely that this sort of broadening comes from some sort of change in the natal spin distribution as a function of redshift. So in the isolated evolution case, I mentioned that the second spin can be spun up by this tidal interaction. And so the strength of that tidal interaction and the efficiency of the spin up is correlated with the separation between the two objects. So the closer you are, the more efficiently you can spin up the second object. And the closer you are also, the faster you merge. So that means you merge at higher redshifts. So this would be one way to imprint a correlation like that. In the case of the formation of black holes from isolated massive stars, there's a relationship between metallicity. So lower metallicity, which occurs at higher redshifts, leads to less efficient stellar winds. And so if you have less efficient stellar winds, that leads to less of the angular momentum being carried away as this envelope is sort of blown off. And so you might have a black hole that's born with a higher spin. And then finally, just a caveat that the correlation we find is only at about 2.5 sigma significance. So it's comparable to other correlations, but it might go away. And hopefully with more observations, we'll be able to either really nail this down or find that it's not really preferred by our data. OK, and so now I'm going to switch gears and tell you about how we can learn about the central engine powering short gamma ray burst jets. So gamma ray bursts are among the most energetic electromagnetic explosions we observe in the universe, but their launch mechanism is unknown. And so we think that if we can understand the geometry of the GRB jet and the emission, this can shed light on the central engine that launches this explosion. And so the way that we traditionally calculate the opening angle of the GRB jet is by relying on a specific observation of a feature in the afterglow light curve called a jet break. And so here you can see a schematic basically of what this looks like. So the gamma rays are beamed into some narrow cone with a half opening angle that we want to measure. And eventually the burst of gamma rays are going to hit the interstellar medium. And when they do, this is going to cause synchrotron radiation that we observe as this multi-wavelength afterglow from the X-rays all the way down to the radio. And at this point, also, the jet is going to begin to slow down and to spread laterally. So when the opening angle of the jet decreases to 1 on the Lorentz factor, this will lead to this steepening of the afterglow light curve. So this is just the flux or the fluence in the afterglow as a function of time. And this is due to two effects. Basically, before this jet break, if we're looking at the GRB sort of down the barrel, we can only see emission from the surface that's very close to our line of sight due to the strong relativistic beaming. But when this jet break occurs, the Lorentz factor has decreased, and so we can see emission from farther away from our line of sight. And so we begin to perceive that the emission is actually not isotropic, so we can tell that there's missing emission relative to what we'd expect if, you know, it were actually isotropic, so we can tell that it's beamed. And then this leads us to basically see this steepening, so we perceive that there's less emission than there was previously. And then the other factor is just that the jet is spreading, and so the energy per solid angle is decreasing. The issue is that this observation is very difficult to make, so it requires, one, you have to observe the afterglow, and two, you have to see the specific feature. So for about the 100 or so short GRBs that we have observed afterglows for, there are on the order of 10 at most that have this jet break feature. And so it's hard to actually make this calculation using this sort of observation. So what we wanted to do is to take advantage of the fact that if you have coincident gravitational wave and electromagnetic observations of a gamma ray burst, this provides you with an independent measurement of the inclination angle and the distance to the source. And so we wanted to fold that into a Bayesian method to constrain the opening angle, the emission profile, and the other properties of the jet without relying on this afterglow jet break observation. And for emission profile, you can see two of the examples that we might want to distinguish between here. On the left is the uniform or top hat jet, where the energy per solid angle is uniform across the entire emitting surface of the jet. And on the right, you can see an example of a structured jet. So in this case, the energy per solid angle and the Lorentz factor fall off as a power law with the angle from the jet axis. And so if we're observing it off axis, you can see this sort of extended emission in the tails of the jet. Okay, and so in order to do this, we need some way to map between the actual observable that we have for the prompt gamma ray emission, which is the fluence, onto these parameters that we want to constrain. And so we do this using the isotropic equivalent energy, which is the energy that you would infer if you assumed that observers at all angles saw the same fluence as you do. And you can see how it's related here. The fluence is just the redshifted EISO divided by the area. And so this is what EISO looks like as a function of different inclination angles for different choices of these jet parameters that we want to constrain. So on the left here is a top hat jet, and you can see that as you increase the Lorentz factor, so as you make the emission more relativistic, the emission drops off more quickly as a function of the angle outside the edge of the jet. So this plateau here just tells you the width of the jet, and then how quickly it drops off depends on the Lorentz factor. And then in the power law structured jet case, you can see that this fall off is much more gradual, as we would expect. And then there's less of a strong signature of the Lorentz factor and the opening angle because you have this, you know, gradual fall off of the energy per solid angle.
Question. Why are they the jet difference that you're consuming that, or is that linked to the Lorentz factor?
No, it's independent. It might be the case that nature gives us a correlation between theta J and Lorentz factor, but we don't know that. And so for the purposes of this demonstration, we're assuming that these are independent parameters.
So this graphs that we saw,
yes, yeah, exactly. And so there are, like, also there's the overall normalization here, which is set by some total energy budget. So there are, you know, these four parameters that you can tune that will give you different values of EISO, exactly. Okay, and so if we use that model, we can see how well we can measure these four parameters for some simulated GRB events. So on the right here, you can see the posteriors on the opening angle, that power law index, the total energy budget, and the Lorentz factor for an uninformative event. So this has a fluence that's below the threshold of what we consider to be a confident GRB detection. And so in this case, you can see that there's broad degeneracy in these posteriors. There's some preference for lower energies because we don't actually make a confident detection. And I should say that here in this case, this preference in the power law index to peak at zero is driven by the prior, because you have to enforce that the Lorentz factor is greater than one at the edge of the jet. If you compare with a much more informative event, so this has a much higher fluence that we would confidently detect as a GRB, you can see that we are able to constrain the total energy much better, but there are still degeneracies between the other parameters, and this is exactly because of the fact that you have four parameters that you're trying to constrain, but you have one measurement, or you know, you have one number that you've observed for the gamma ray prompt emission. Okay, so you might think that not all GRBs are going to have the same opening angle, Lorentz factor, and energy budget, and so we want to use this population approach again to measure the distributions from which these parameters are drawn.
Oh, wait, sorry.
Yeah.
So in the previous plots, so for there, was the assumption that you're only using the gamma ray prompt, gamma ray emission, nothing about the afterglow?
Nothing about the afterglow. And we're folding in what we know about the inclination angle and the distance from the gravitational wave observations. Yeah.
But if you included like afterglow information, presumably that would help this.
Yes, it would help. The idea that we wanted to see was basically, if we only have the prompt gamma ray and we don't have the afterglow, can we still learn something? Since not all GRBs that we see have an afterglow, and so we thought, you know, let's just be afterglow agnostic for now. Okay, right. And so again, we're going to assume that the distributions from which, like, the opening angle and the Lorentz factor are drawn are Gaussian with some unknown means and widths that we're going to measure. And so to see how well we can measure these parameters, we simulate 100 binary neutron star events that are detectable with gravitational waves, and assume that each one has a corresponding fluence measurement or upper limit. So we don't necessarily need to detect 100 coincident gravitational waves and GRBs. We just have to say, you know, was the gamma ray telescope pointing in the right part of the sky to have observed something if the emission was like bright enough. And so we're sort of taking a naive approach to GRB selection effects, which we thought was okay for this proof of concept, since GRB satellites are more or less all sky instruments. Okay, and so here you can see how our constraint on the mean and the width of the total energy distribution changes as a function of the number of events that we include in our population. So this total energy is easier to measure for the top hat jet population compared to a structured jet population, because it has a more prominent effect on the normalization of EISO. And we find that with 100 detections, we can measure the mean and width to within about two orders of magnitude at one sigma credibility. We don't measure the Lorentz factor very well because it requires you to sort of fall right on the edge of the jet to see how quickly the emission falls off, but we can get a better constraint on the opening angle. So we find similar constraints on the opening angle for both emission profiles, the top hat and the power law structured jet, and we find that we can measure the mean to within about 10 degrees at one sigma credibility. And then we also wanted to see whether we could distinguish between the structure in the emission profile. So here's our recovery on the mean of this power law index for a top hat jet and for a structured jet population. And you can see that, you know, even with few detections, in the case of the structured jet, this mean peaks away from zero, even though it takes, you know, a lot of detections for it to start peaking around the true value. But the idea is that you can distinguish structure in the population when it's there using this approach. Okay, and so to conclude this section, we developed a new method for measuring the gamma ray burst jet geometry that does not require the observation of a multi-wavelength afterglow. It just requires you to have a measurement of the fluence or the upper limb, an upper limit on the fluence in gamma rays, and also a coincident gravitational wave observation. For a single high SNR event, we can constrain the log energy of the jet, but the other parameters are highly degenerate. But with a population of 100 coincident events, we can measure the mean of the opening angle distribution to within about 10 degrees, and we find clear evidence in favor of the jet angular profile structure when it's present. And so the idea is that, you know, hopefully we can build up some empirical constraints on these parameters and then turn those over to the theorists and say, you know, what sort of central engine can produce jets that look like this? Yes.
Yeah, so I guess with the 100 events, you'd expect to see some after glow. Have you done the calculation comparing like the information you get there versus the information you get with like some fraction of these having afterglows on the jet properties?
We have not. We haven't built in any afterglow information into this method, but that'd be a good way to extend it.
Just the information you get from like the afterglows versus the information you get from this, are they comparable or is it doing a lot better?
Well, so I guess we can take 17817 as a example case. It was very highly studied and we were able to resolve the jet in VLBI, and so that told us pretty much exactly what the opening angle of that specific jet was. And so I guess if you had a couple of those, probably you could infer a population sort of on a similar level, although the, you know, the sub-threshold ones that we can probe here that are not individually informative for these parameters still do contribute. And so I can't tell you which one would win, but I think a natural way to extend this would be like to build in those, you know, very informative events that we do get a lot of information from the afterglow into this model and sort of fit everything at once. Yeah.
Yeah. So similar question. So for this forecast, were you only using the events that had both gamma ray and gravitational wave detections?
So we said we're only going to use those that are definitely detected in gravitational waves, and then there's some sort of upper limit on the detection in gamma ray. So it didn't need to be a confident detection of a GRB. It just needed to be like, this is the best we could measure the fluence for this at this time in this part of the sky. And so I guess if you look here, for example, you can see there are these sorts of jumps in this profile. These are going to be driven by, oh, that one was an event that we did confidently detect a GRB for. And so that, you know, carries a lot of information and that's going to affect our population level constraints. But there is still some information gained also from those sub-threshold sort of weak events that we only have an upper limit for.
Yes, the orphan detections were also included.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. As for when we might be able to get a population of this size, not during the next observing run, but maybe the one after that at design sensitivity at 05, we may be able to get 100 binary neutron star events. Okay. And so for the last part of the talk, I'm going to tell you about how we can learn about early universe processes like preheating and phase transitions using the detection of a stochastic gravitational wave background. Okay, so this stochastic gravitational wave background is a random signal produced by many overlapping and individually indistinguishable sources. So these can be both cosmological and astrophysical in nature. The astrophysical background might come from all the very, very weak subthreshold binary black hole and binary neutron star mergers overlapping that we can't detect individually. And the cosmological background can come from early universe processes like inflation and some of those other ones like phase transitions, cosmic strings that I mentioned. So in contrast to the gravitational waves that we have detected so far from compact binary mergers, these are persistent and unmodeled. So this signal is always on, and we don't have a deterministic prediction for what it should look like. We assume that it's a Gaussian process. While the, you know, binary black holes, they're transient, they're only in band for a short segment of time, and we have very good predictions for what they should look like. And so we typically parameterize the stochastic background in terms of this omega GW parameter that I mentioned. It's the ratio of the energy density contained in gravitational waves to the critical energy density needed to close the universe, or this slice of the total energy pi that comes from gravitational waves. And we usually say that its spectrum follows a power law with some amplitude and an unknown power law index. Okay, so this background of unresolvable compact object binary mergers that I mentioned is highly non-Gaussian, and it has an estimated amplitude of 10 to the 9. So the reason that it's non-Gaussian is because these mergers are very short-lived in the LIGO band, so they last, you know, at most the order of a few seconds for binary black holes, and the time between mergers is longer than the duration of the mergers. And so they overlap to produce this sort of popcorn background. The primordial backgrounds from cosmological sources are actually Gaussian, but they are much weaker. So depending on your favorite cosmological model, this can be as small as 10 to the minus 17 in amplitude, or as loud as 10 to the minus 10. And so the way that we usually try to probe this very weak cosmological signal is by subtracting all the individual compact object mergers that happen in the foreground. The issue is that this only works if you can confidently identify that there's a compact object merger. And so all those really quiet subthreshold things are going to contaminate your measurement of this cosmological background. And so you can see here a demonstration of just how big this disparity is between this astrophysical background and the cosmological background. You can see here the expected background from slow roll inflation, while these backgrounds from binary black hole and binary neutron star mergers are a lot louder. And you can see the sensitivity of ground-based gravitational wave detectors sort of approaching this astrophysical foreground. However, with the next generation of ground-based gravitational wave detectors, we expect to be able to probe interesting cosmological backgrounds. So here you can see the sensitivity of various next-generation detector networks to this omega GW parameter as a function of frequency. And we are potentially going to be able to start probing some interesting predictions for like preheating and phase transitions, although the detection of the background from inflation is still likely going to be out of reach. Okay, and so traditionally, when we search for this stochastic gravitational wave background, we make the statistical assumptions that it's isotropic, unpolarized, stationary, and Gaussian. So isotropic just means it's the same in all directions. Unpolarized means that there's equal power in the two gravitational wave polarizations. Stationary means it's the same at all times. And Gaussian, we've talked about, just means that it's the time series follows a Gaussian process. And in order to search for this signal, we have to assume that the strain in each detector is the sum of a signal component and a noise component. And if you have two detectors or more that are sufficiently far apart, the noise is going to be uncorrelated, but the signal will be coherent. And so you can cross-correlate the strain observed in each of these detectors. And if you find excess power, that will be due to this stochastic gravitational wave background. However, as we've said, this assumption of Gaussianity is suboptimal for the background from these sub-threshold compact object mergers. So instead of assuming that the signal is persistent and unmodeled, you can build in what we know about the properties of the signal. So in this optimal search method that was developed by Smith and Thrain a number of years ago, the procedure is basically you split your data into short segments, and you can, in each segment, use a deterministic waveform model to calculate the probability that that particular segment contains a merger or not, even for the most weak subthreshold mergers. And then you combine your segments to get a number for the total fraction of segments that contain a merger, which is a proxy for the merger rate and for omega GW. And so if you build in these more detailed statistical assumptions about the astrophysical background into your search method, you can reduce the time to detection from the order of years to the order of hours, because you're basically modeling the non-Gaussianity of the signal. Nope, you just treat them in the same way. And so, I mean, you could, you can impose some sort of backwards selection effects where you say, I'm going to ignore everything that's really loud. But the idea here is that you're really just analyzing all segments of data equally. You don't have any selection effects. And so everything contributes to your this estimate of the fraction of segments that contain signal.
Oh, sweet. So maybe those signal will be there for a long time. So how long is the segment?
Yeah, so it's been demonstrated with binary black holes only. We haven't done it with neutron stars, but that's something we're planning on expanding to. And the idea is that you choose your segment so that the likelihood of having multiple mergers per segment is very small. So for BBH, it's safe to choose a 4-second segment. For binary neutron stars, you'd have to make it a lot smaller because they will overlap. Okay, and so what we wanted to do is to expand that framework to add the presence of a stochastic Gaussian cosmological background. So in each segment, instead of just saying, is there a compact binary, you say, is there a compact binary, and what are the parameters of the stochastic background? And so in this way, you can avoid the contamination of the Gaussian background because you're accounting for both types of signals at once, and you're also including the uncertainty in your recovery of the binary parameters in your estimate of the Gaussian background parameters. So instead of just choosing one signal to subtract, that you know you may have chosen slightly the wrong signal, and so you'll end up with some residual contamination, you're subtracting all possible signals, basically. And so in the end, what this looks like is you're just taking a weighted sum of the probability distributions inferred for those stochastic background parameters, the amplitude and the slope, under the signal model where you have a compact binary merger and the noise model where you don't. And basically, we wanted to see if we could show that this works. So we simulate some data using a Hanford-Livingston detector network, assuming LIGO design sensitivity. And we, as I said, break the data into these 4-second segments. And in each, we add a Gaussian cosmological background with an amplitude of 10 to the minus 6 and a slope of 0. So this is obviously a lot louder than we expect for real cosmological backgrounds, but we chose this value to sort of reduce the computational cost of the demonstration because otherwise we would have to analyze a lot more data. And so we just chose this high value as a proof of principle. And so we simulate 101 segments, which means that the SNR in our Gaussian background is 5.4. And then in 11 of the 101 segments, we add a binary black hole signal. And the signal-to-noise ratios range from 2 to 12. The median is 3.5. And it's only the loudest event that would be a confident detection. So the other 10 signals are all of these really weak subthreshold sources that we wouldn't be able to detect individually. And so we probably wouldn't be able to subtract in the traditional method. And then we use a computational trick to sort of break this calculation down into two steps to facilitate combining the segments. Okay, and so here are our results. These are the posteriors on the log of the amplitude, the slope, and the fraction of segments that contain a merger. And so you can see here that our recovery of these parameters is unbiased, and we also have no sensitivity loss. So we are able to recover the full SNR that we injected in the cosmological background without, you know, losing sensitivity due to the contamination of the foreground. Okay, so to summarize this section, we've demonstrated the statistically optimal method for the simultaneous detection of a Gaussian background and an astrophysical foreground. If you don't have an astrophysical foreground, there's no advantage to using this full evasion method. You can safely use your cross-correlation search for excess power. But in reality, we know that there's going to be a foreground on top of our cosmological background. And so the framework is flexible, and we can extend it to include the uncertainty in the binary black hole mass spin and redshift distributions, so simultaneously infer the population distributions for these very weak sources and the cosmological background. And also, we plan to expand it to include the BNS foreground, which, as I said, requires a slight redefinition of what we call the analysis segment. And then the method is also applicable to multiple Gaussian backgrounds with different spectral shapes. So if you have different early universe processes, and one you expect to produce a flat background, and the other one will have some different power law. You can search for them at the same time. And it's also worth noting that this is going to be useful for LISA as well, because LISA, which is like LIGO in space, is going to be dominated by this foreground of inspiraling double white dwarfs. And we are interested in detecting individual supermassive black hole mergers on top of that. So the double white dwarf foreground is actually truly Gaussian, while you can look for non-Gaussian signals on top of it. OK, and just to conclude on.
If you have, let's say, a million subs to actually invest, like how much time does it take from the Bayesian framework and finally become the primordial wave framework?
It's basically limited by how long it takes to run parameter estimation on one segment. So using the current methods that we have now, if we use reduced order quadrature and some marginalizations in likelihood, we can analyze a 4-second binary black hole signal in like 15 minutes. If you go to binary neutron stars, then the signal is longer, and so it takes longer. But people are working on optimizing the parameter estimation methods.
So each second, you don't want multiple events, you only want like at most one event.
Yeah.
So like for 3G, you have a million events, let's say. So that means your second is shorter.
Yeah.
So that means your computation time will be.
Yeah, it's very computationally expensive, but we have 15 years to figure out how to run parameter estimation on BNS on the order of seconds. There are promising avenues that are being pursued, including like machine learning methods, and so I think we'll figure it out by then.
So I assume you're injecting the signal and then recovering it with the same like waveform model.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be easy to like look at kind of like systematics there by like injecting with one and with a different waveform model?
Yeah, that could certainly be done.
That's something that you're not worried about, or something that
I think it's something that we should look at in the future, just to be able to say we're not worried about it. I'm not too worried about it at the moment, but yeah, we can easily do that test.
Yeah, and this recovery, do you expect this to depend on the fire? Because if you have some fire for all the events, then maybe that will introduce the same kind of fire.
So it will depend on the prior space that you accommodate for your compact object mergers. So if, for example, you only look for binary black holes with masses between 30 and 60, but you have a large population of sources that have masses 20, then you won't find those, and they will contaminate your Gaussian background. So you need to basically cover the parameter space well enough that you're not missing things just because you've excluded them from your prior.
Or, for example, the mass distribution, right?
Yeah, so that actually we have looked at on the effect of like assuming the wrong shape of the mass distribution. We find that it doesn't have a big effect at the level like that we can probe now. It might have a bigger effect for 3G, but it's really like the edges of the prior that matter the most. So the shape doesn't have a huge impact. But ideally, you would build in the inference of the shape into your whole formalism. So then you wouldn't have to worry about that. OK. And then at the very end, I'll just tell you, what I think is next on the horizon for these topics that I've spoken on. So as Colm also mentioned yesterday, we're finding that a lot of the conclusions about the binary black hole population are still model driven. So in addition to these parametric or phenomenological models, we should consider alternative approaches, including the non-parametric models like the slines, or direct parametrization in terms of theoretical models, like the output of binary population synthesis. I'm optimistic that binary neutron star observations over the next few years will tell us a lot about their properties and those of their electromagnetic counterparts using multi-messenger observations. So for example, offering joint constraints on the neutron star equation of state and kilonova properties like composition and geometry. And then I think some of these data analysis challenges that we've talked about for the next generation of detectors will affect the detectability of the cosmological background, but you know, we can start working now on a fully Bayesian method to deal with issues like overlapping signals, uncertainties in the noise model, and waveform system patterns. And I'm happy to take any other questions.
First, do we have questions from the online audience? No? Any questions from the
group? For the third part, I'm wondering, is your method of work for a single detector, because you don't need, you don't rely on any cross correlation, right?
No, so the... You do implicitly rely on a cross-correlation because the Gaussian signal is otherwise indistinguishable from Gaussian noise in your detector. So if you just try to measure, for example, the PSD in your detector, what you're really measuring is the noise of the detector plus any sort of Gaussian signals that contribute to that Gaussian signal that you observe. And so you do need multiple detectors in order to be able to like measure the cross power between them for the Gaussian component still. For the, if you're only looking at the astrophysical background, then you could in principle do it with one detector, but then you also have to have a really good model for distinguishing, you know, the various non-Gaussian things that might be in your data. So is it a signal or is it a glitch, basically? And so we think that adding one or more detectors is going to make it more reliable because then you can look for coherence as a way to distinguish glitches from real signals.
Thank you.
Any additional questions?
Well, so on this slide, so this slide corresponded, you said, to omega 10 to the minus 6?
Yeah.
So does this log EF of my model, like, you know, does that correspond to the 4 or 5?
It corresponds to a signal-to-noise ratio of about 5. So this scales as the SNR squared divided by 2. So we are basically recovering at comparable statistical significance to what we injected. So SNR 5 is somewhere close to 5 sigma. Yeah.
Okay, great. So therefore, for like, you know, for the omegas that you said, you know, might be more realistic, then what's your signal to noise then?
Then you just need to observe for longer to build that like confidence in your signal.
Okay, so
yeah.
This was
404 seconds of data. We also didn't really simulate a realistic population, so we had, you know, 11 binary black holes and 400 seconds of data, which is too many compared to what we think actually exists in the universe. But for the purposes of the demonstration, we sort of just like tuned these parameters so that we could prove that this works in principle without, you know, running huge computational analyses for longer periods of time.
Just to mark, what sort of tensor to scalar ratio would this omega correspond to?
I do not know. No, sorry.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank you.